of Capernaum, life in the village began to seem less burdensome, though he would have been surprised if he had stopped to realize it. The long, hot days of the month of Ab came to be the happiest he had ever known. He went, first because Yoel had asked him to, and because he was still curious to find what it was about the preacher that had drawn first Simone and then Yoel. 2 days later, he went back again, because he could not get the words of the carpenter out of his head. After that, nearly every morning in the week, he rose before dawn and walked 3 miles to the city to join the little crowd that always waited at the shore. Though it meant that his shop would be late in opening, Simone encouraged his coming and seemed glad to see him. Daniel could meet Yoel and talk with him freely, and often he had the added reward of Thashia's flashing smile. Even the fishermen came to greet him by name. It was harder to explain to himself why he sometimes was drawn to Bethsaida at night, when he could not expect to meet Yoel, and when he could only sit in the little garden of Simone's house and listen to the words of Jesus. He did not always understand the words, and often he walked home puzzled and impatient. But a few nights later, almost against his will, he would go again. He was still not sure what Jesus intended to do, but day after day, the hope and promise in Jesus' words drew him back. At mealtimes, he told Leah the stories he had heard. Sometimes, he thought that if the long walks to Capernaum and the hours away from his work had accomplished nothing else, they had at least given him something to talk to Leah about.
"Was Andrew there?" she would ask. "Did he have a lot of fish in his net? Did the rich women come and bring food for the poor people?"
She would sit with her own food untouched, wanting only to listen. Often, when he returned late at night, she would bounce up on her mat, her eyes shining with wakefulness, and hug her knees with her arms. Even when he was too tired to think he would manage some bit of news before he climbed to his bed on the rooftop, or the disappointment in her face would nag at him. It puzzled him that this timid creature, who had never dared to venture beyond their tiny garden patch, should now be so curious about the busy life of the city. How could he possibly make her see it, when she had never even glimpsed the little crossroads and the well and the small flat synagogue that made up the center of their own village? "I like to go in the morning best," he told her, "when the fishermen are just coming in with their night's catch. Some of the families have been bringing their boats in at the same spot for years, so that everyone takes it for granted that certain places belong to certain men. That's why no one really dares to interfere when Jesus sits and talks, because everyone knows that that spot belongs by right to Simone and Andrew."
"Why should they want to interfere?"
"The overseers think he keeps the men from starting their work, not the fishermen. They have been out all night, and their work is done. It's the men loading the trading boats who stop and listen when they should be working, and people like me with work waiting to be done at home." There was so much he could never find words to make her see. The lake, gray and still at sunrise. The hills beyond like huddled sheep. The first lines of camels and donkeys coming sleepily to the water's edge. The crowing of a cock somewhere in the town. And the first busy chirping of sparrows, and, abruptly, the swifts, coming from nowhere, filling the air, darting over the water. And then suddenly the sun, leaping over the hills, warm and yellow, so that the mists melted and the lake shone blue and sparkling. The boats coming in, dragging the nets with their heaving burdens of fish. The smoke of little fires quickly lighted, and the fragrance of roasting fish. Worth getting up in the dark, even when his tired muscles pleaded for a little more rest. Worth the long walk to the city and the waiting. But how could he put it into words? And how could he tell of the people, the women who came down to help their men spread the wet nets on the shore? The almost naked men, their shoulders glistening, dragging the heavy baskets up from the boats, spreading the fish on flat stones to be salted and dried. The never-ending lines of men with sacks of grain and baskets of fruits and vegetables.
Jesus stands on the shore and talks to them all, he told Leah. His friends to start with, and people like me. And then there are the beggars and cripples. Heaven knows where they sleep, but every morning they drag themselves down to the shore, partly to hear Jesus, and partly because Simone and Andrew and the women always give them some fish. Then there are curious people who come because they see a crowd. It drives the overseers crazy when their men stop to listen. Sooner or later, they break in and drive the men away. Sometimes, Jesus gets into one of Simone's boats and goes out from shore a little. That way, they can't order him away, but the crowds on the shore can still hear him.
What did he say to them today?
She would ask. And Daniel would do his best to remember. He would try to call back the lakeside and hear the lap of the water and the shouts of the workmen and even the breathing of the men and women packed close around him. He could hear their stillness and that deep, steady voice. Sometimes he could remember almost word for word because Jesus had left an unforgettable picture in his mind. He told us a story about a traveler who fell among thieves who beat him and left him half dead beside the road. And a priest and a Levite came by and saw him and passed by on the other side. But a cursed Samaritan stopped and bound up his wounds and took care of him. I wish the story had been about a Jew instead. If Jesus means that Jews and Samaritans should treat each other like neighbors, that is foolish. It could never happen. Often the words themselves eluded him, and only the memory of the voice struck troubled echoes deep within him. It was true. He did like best to go in the morning, not only because he loved the lake at dawn and the bustle of work beginning, and the walk back through the fields fresh washed from the night dew, but also because then, in the clear, bright sunlight, nothing seemed impossible. He could truly believe that the kingdom of God was coming nearer, and he could almost hear the sound of trumpets in the distant hills. When he went to the city in the evening, everything seemed different, and he was not so sure. A sadness seemed to hang over the world. At night, people came flocking to the home of Simone the fisherman, where Jesus lived in a booth on the rooftop. There the workers would gather, weary from a day of hard labor at the forge or the wharves or the vineyards. They would crowd into the small room, spilling out and filling the narrow yard, sprawling on the trampled earth, so close packed that one could scarcely find a way between the bodies. It was at night that the hungry, who had not eaten all day, came to be fed, and the down and out and worthless. It was at night that they brought their kinfolk on litters. The air was thick with the day's heat and the stench of bodies and the smell of fever. The eyes of the ill and lame, which looked up with hope in the new morning, were glazed at night with a long day's suffering. Daniel was disgusted at the way they jostled each other and tore at the food and snatched bread from the helpless, and at the way no one bothered when some poor creature who could only crawl on hands and knees was passed over or even trodden on. At night, Jesus too looked weary. His brilliant flashing eyes were dark with pity. Yet he never turned away, never refused to speak to them. While he talked, they all forgot for a while. You could see their faces, turned upward to the light that streamed from the open door. And you could see that his words touched their minds and hearts, like some healing ointment, and that the scars on their spirits that came from being beaten and kicked and turned away all day long lost their smart and for a short time did not matter. Often a man's body was healed, and he leaped up, full of new strength, and then a new hope coursed through them all. But as Daniel went home, with the black heat pressing him down, all the misery he had seen dragged at him, clinging like burrs to his spirit, and he did not hear any distant trumpets. On these nights, it was difficult to find anything to tell Leah. When he lay down and tried to sleep, the same question went on and on in his mind. When? When? How long must the world go on like this? There was one story he almost wished he had not told Leah, because she asked for it over and over again. Tell me about the little girl who was sick, she would beg. Daniel would repeat the words that he had said so often that they were like a lesson memorized in school. Jesus went to her house and,
No, begin at the beginning,
she would demand like a child,
when you were waiting on the beach.
So he would begin, knowing that nothing but the whole story, just as he had told it so many times, would satisfy her. We were waiting on the beach. Jesus had been across the lake to visit some of the villages, he and some of his followers, and they were coming back in a boat. People had been waiting for him since before dawn, and they were hungry and hot. But they were bound they wouldn't leave before they had seen him. Finally, someone saw the boat coming, and they all stood up and strained their eyes. And as it got nearer, they went wild. You'd have thought he was a prince, the way they screamed and cheered. It was all Simone and James could do to make room for him to step on shore. I think Simone was trying to persuade him to get back into the boat again, the way he sometimes has to do, because for all they call him master and teacher, they lose their wits and have no regard for him at all. But just then, there was a shout behind the crowd, and everyone turned around. Those in the back were pushing to make room for someone, and we saw a man trying to get through to Jesus. You all whispered, It's Jairus. And then people began to step on each other's toes to get out of the way. Some of them tried to hide behind the others for fear Jairus would recognize them. Jairus is one of the rulers of the synagogue. I think even you all looked a little scared. Jesus' friends moved up close around him. No one was quite sure what was going to happen, but Jesus made a sign for them to stand aside, and he just stood quietly and waited. Jairus passed very close to me. His cloak was twisted sideways, and he was panting as though he had been running, and no one need have bothered to hide, because he did not see anyone or anything except the one man he was looking for. What happened was the last thing we expected. Jairus went down in front of Jesus like a beggar and stretched out his hands, and his voice was so low and hoarse that only those who stood very near could understand what he said. But the word went through the crowd. His daughter was dying, the only child he had. Then Jesus said,
No, tell me first what Yoel said.
Oh, Yoel said, The only child he has, poor man. She is the apple of his eye.
The apple of his eye,
Leia would repeat softly, caressing the words. Of course I felt sorry for him, but I thought too, what a chance it was for Jesus, an important man like this, a ruler. I thought if Jesus could bargain with him. But of course, he would never think of that. He only reached out his hand and helped the man up and started straight for Jairus' house. The crowd let him through and then flocked after like a bunch of sheep, and me along with them, because when a crowd like that starts to move, you don't stop to think. I was curious as anyone to see what would happen. But halfway to the synagogue, we saw a man hurrying along the street, and he met Jairus and Jesus and stopped them. I could not hear what he said, but I could see his face, and I knew that he had bad news. They told me afterwards that he said the girl was dead and not to bother the teacher anymore. But before Jairus could speak, Jesus put his hand on the man's arm and said something quietly. And they went on again, and all of us after. Then we heard the women wailing, and the flutes playing, and the women in the crowd began to howl too, out of sympathy. And Jesus turned around to us and said, Do not weep. She is not dead, but sleeping. And none of us knew what to think. The women at the door of the house were weeping and jeering at him, both at the same time. Then Jesus told the crowd to stay back, and he gave a sign to Simone and John and James, the three who were always nearest to him, and he took them into the house with him. And in a moment, all the mourners who had been wailing in the house came out. Some of them were angry, and some of them were frightened, but Jairus shut the door behind them.
I wish you had gone inside,
Leia would say now. Well, I couldn't, and neither could any of the others, except those three. We have only their word for what happened. They said the child lay on her bed, They would have sworn, too, that she was dead. But Jesus did not hesitate at all. He just walked up to the bed and reached down and took her hand and spoke to her.
"Tell me," Leah would whisper. "Tell me exactly what he said."
He said, "Little girl, get up," just as though she were asleep. And she woke and got up and walked. And then Jesus said, "Give her something to eat." And he went away before her father or mother had a chance to say anything. When he came out to the street, no one dared to ask what had happened because there was something about his face. I can't describe it, but I have seen him look like that at other times, as though he had come to the very end of his strength. Simone and John understand when he looks like that, and they got him through the crowd and back to their house, and everyone knew better than to try to follow.
"The little girl, she was really well?"
"Yes. I have seen her walking with her father. You'd never guess she had been ill."
"Is she pretty?"
"Yes," Daniel would say, although he had not actually noticed, because it seemed to please Leia to have her pretty.
"Yes," Leia would sigh. "Of course she must be pretty, and she must be very happy."
Daniel wished she would not keep asking for the story. It had seemed wonderful to him at the time, but it had a puzzling aspect as well. It hadn't seemed to make any difference. Some of the followers thought that Jairus had offered to pay Jesus and that Jesus had refused. And Daniel could not understand this when all those people were clamoring to be fed every night and Jairus would never have missed the money. At any rate, the thing had been hushed up by Jesus' own order, they said. Some of the disciples had grumbled about it too. Simone, who had been in the house when it happened, would not talk about it at all. But Daniel noticed that Simone seldom went out in his boat now, that he stayed close to Jesus wherever he went. The fisherman watched his teacher more carefully than ever, protecting him from the carelessness of the crowd. And when Jesus spoke, Simone's eyes never left his face. One day, as Daniel finished the story, Leia sat silent for a long time.
"Do you think Jesus will ever come to our village?"
she asked finally. "He did once, and he may again."
"If he came here, would there be a great crowd of people?"
"There always is, wherever he goes."
"Like the people who watched the day we came here?"
"You think that was a crowd? That was only a handful. Where Jesus is, they come by hundreds." He could see she had no way of imagining people by hundreds.
"Do women come?"
"Of course."
"Do the people crowd together and push each other?"
"It's all you can do to stay on your 2 feet sometimes."
She was silent so long that he thought she had stopped thinking about it. Then she asked, "Are there children too?"
"Oh, yes. Usually some children."
"Do they hurt the children?"
"Of course they don't. What gave you such an idea?"
"Jesus wouldn't let them hurt the children, would he?"
"He won't even let them send the children away when they're a nuisance. He insists on talking to them and finding out their names and listening to their foolishness. It makes some of the men furious, as though he thought children were important." She sat silent for a long time, and this time, Daniel asked, very carefully, "If he comes, will you go with me to see him?" Leia did not speak, only lowered her head and hid her face behind her veil. How changed she is, he thought, filled with hope as he looked at his sister. It must be Thasia's visits. For Thasia came often now, walking out from the city with Yoel to stay with Leia while the boys met in the watchtower. Each time, she brought some small gift, a lily bulb to plant in the garden, a tiny alabaster jar of perfume, a skein of scarlet thread. She had opened for Leia a whole new world. After Thasia's last visit, he had come into the house and found Leia peering into the tiny hand mirror of polished bronze that had been Thasia's latest gift, peering so earnestly that she had not even heard him come in. There had been something in her face, a searching and a wistfulness that still haunted him. Sometimes when he talked, she did not seem to hear him at all, but seemed to be listening intently for some expected sound. Often, there was a dreaming look in her blue eyes. Twice, when the first patter of early rain had passed like footsteps along the street outside, she had flown to the garden door and flung it open and stood looking out into the dark, damp garden. Girls were strange creatures. Would Thacia understand all this? Perhaps it was only his imagining, but it stirred in him an odd uneasiness that he could not put into words. There was another satisfaction in these days. As Daniel grew confident of the skill in his own hands, his work became a source of pleasure. It was satisfying to give a villager a pair of hinges for his house, and know that they were not only strong and well-balanced, but exactly matched and pleasing to look at as well. He became aware that something more than usefulness could take shape under his hammer, and he began to experiment. One sultry afternoon, when the work was slack, he picked from the floor a bit of bronze which had dropped from a molten mass. Seeing its dull shine between his fingers, he had an idea. He heated it carefully, pulled it from the fire with the smallest tongs, and tapped it gently with Simone's finest hammer. After several tries, he achieved a stroke delicate enough so that it would not flatten the small lump, and presently he managed to beat out a fine wire. He heated it again and twisted it between his fingers, and watched it slowly take the shape of a tiny slender bow, no longer than his little finger. For a moment, he stared at it with pure pleasure. Then he had a further inspiration. He rolled out and sharpened a slender bronze pin, which could pass down like an arrow between the bow and the fine wire of its string, so that the bow became a brooch soon as he had seen the city folk wear to fasten their cloaks. Then he hid his experiment away, half ashamed of it and half proud. He would keep it to remind him of his purpose. "He trains my hands for war, so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze." He thought again of Jesus, and his hopes flared anew. Surely this man, like David of old, had the strength of God in him. If he willed, he could bend the bow of bronze. But was Jesus training his hands for war? Daniel was not sure. He must go back again that night to the garden in Bethsaida. For Daniel, the month of Ab was a time of waiting. It was only afterwards that he remembered these days as a time of quietness and hope. 16. The Bronze Bow.
"I'll do anything, Daniel. You know that. Anything."
Yuel's voice shook with earnestness. His eyes in the flickering lamplight were fixed on his friend's face. The three sat crouched in the narrow passageway of Yuel's home. Earlier that day, Daniel had received a summons by messenger from Roche. He had climbed to the cave and then, after a brief conference, had gone straight to the city. Shortly before dark, Yuel and Thacia had crept through the passageway to join him. Daniel brought with him the long-awaited orders from Roche to Yuel. At first, waiting in the dark passageway, Daniel had battled with his own jealousy, that Yuel should have the first chance to act, while he himself, the one who had brought Yuel in as a recruit, should stand aside and wait. But now he was beginning to see the thing reasonably. This was only the beginning. "Roche needs some information," he told his eager friend. "You're the only one who can get it, Yuel. You know your way around the city, and everyone is used to seeing you. None of the rest of us could get near." "What does Roche want? I'll get it, whatever it is," Daniel told him, his voice echoing the contempt with which Galileans always spoke of the Tetrarch. The half-Jew, Herod Antipas, who had been appointed to rule over them, and of the extravagant city he had built on the sea. "Herod is entertaining a special legation from Rome. While they're at Tiberias, they plan to come up to Capernaum for a day or so to inspect the garrison here. For some people, the rich ones who toady to Rome, that will be a great occasion. Mattathias, the banker, is giving a banquet for the whole legation, and some of the richest men in Capernaum will be there." "Mattathias would do anything to gain favor with the Tetrarch. said Yuel with scorn. How does Roche know about the banquet? Don't ask me how. He has his own ways. What he wants to know is what others will be there, the names of all of them, and the day and the time when the banquet will take place. Yuel nodded. I can see why. It would give us a good idea which men would be against us. Any Jew who would eat at the Tetrarch's table. That's it. We need to know our enemies as well as our friends. Is that all I have to do? Just find out those things? Yuel looked disappointed. You may not find it so easy. Roche didn't have any idea how you'd go about it. He left all that to you. How will I get the word to Roche? Asked Yuel, looking flattered. I'll take care of that. Bring what you find to me, or send it by one of the band, someone we can trust. I'll see that it gets to Roche. Yoel's eyes began to sparkle at the thought of intrigue. Let's see, he began. It doesn't really help that people know me here. That kind would hold their tongues because of father. I don't think I'd find out a thing. Besides, Mattathias and father don't speak to each other. No, the servants are the ones to talk to. If I could get into the servants, if I could sell something. Fish! Thashia broke in. You could get all the fish you want from Simone and Andrew. At moments like this, caught up in the same excitement, the brother and sister were unmistakably twins. Good idea, Yoel flashed. I'll get a basket full of extra fine ones and peddle them for a good price. I can say I'll take orders for any special occasion. You know how the kitchen slaves talk about a party. I'm sure it would work. Struggling with envy again, Daniel sat silent. Yuel was too excited to wonder why he, the youngest of the group, should have been given this assignment. The truth was, Daniel knew, Roche had no one else to send. The band in the mountains boasted more muscle than wit. How far would he himself get, with his smith's shoulders and his country manners? Yuel had to be the one. Then, watching Yuel's rapt, flushed face, Daniel felt not envy, but unexpected misgiving. If anything went wrong? He glanced at Thashia. Her eyes met his, and in them he saw his own doubt suddenly mirrored. Yuel, he said, you don't have to do this. Roche has no right to order you. Why hasn't he? If he asked you, it's different with me. Why is it different? I'm a nobody. You have your future to think of, and your father and mother, and Thashia. No, said Thashia quickly. Not me. I took the oath with you, remember? Only, Daniel, is this a dangerous thing? Stop fussing, both of you, said Yuel with new importance. Let me think. I can get the fish early, before it's light. But suppose father finds out I'm not in school. Perhaps I could ask him for a holiday. Thashia leaned forward. Yuel, I have an idea. What if you and Daniel were seen going out of the city tomorrow morning? Suppose you passed the guards and even spoke to them, so if we needed, people could swear they had seen you. Wouldn't that leave you free to do anything you like? Yuel stared at his sister, and then his face came alive like hers. Face! Why didn't I think of it? Would you do it? Honestly? You know I would. As always, Daniel was baffled by the swiftness with which these two caught up each other's thoughts and left him stumbling behind. I don't see, he said, annoyed. Yoel laughed. We've done it plenty of times in the past just for the fun of it. When we were little and our hair was short, we used to change clothes. And sometimes, we fooled the neighbors. The nearsighted ones, at least. Of course, she's shorter now. But unless we stand side by side, who would notice? Daniel caught on. You mean... Of course. Yuel interrupted him as he did his sister, without realizing it. Thais wears my clothes, and with her hair back under the turban, who's to know she's not a boy? Then you two go about together. I'll arrange for a day off. You could go, oh, somewhere out of the city would be best, where we're not too well known.
We'll go to visit Leia. I've been wanting to for days.
In the face of their enthusiasm, Daniel's scruples melted. Before he crept out of the passageway and set out for the village, the three had agreed to meet next morning by the boats of Simone and Andrew. Before dawn, Daniel joined the farmers on the road to the city. At the harbor, the usual crowd waited hopefully by the fishing boats. As he drew nearer, two boys moved from the rest and came to meet him. One was a sturdy barefoot fisherman in a rough cotton tunic, his throat and arms bare. The other made Daniel gasp. Beneath a close-bound turban was half-hidden a second Yoel. Younger, smooth-faced, more finely drawn, but with the same lustrous eyes. Thassia tipped back her head for Daniel's scrutiny in a gesture that reminded him of Leia.
"It's not quite so perfect as it used to be,"
she admitted cheerfully.
"We better keep away from the marketplace. Once out of town, I'll be safe."
Both brother and sister were relishing their conspiracy. Their high spirits made his own doubts seem niggardly. Yoel had already arranged for a consignment of fish and had them hidden under a half-upturned boat, packed under fresh green leaves in a woven basket. Presently, he set off with a swaggering step and a wide grin. Then Thassia took control with a brisk efficiency that surprised Daniel.
"We'll go this way," she directed. "We won't be so likely to meet anyone."
"Aren't you going to wait?" Daniel asked, surprised. "Jesus will be here soon."
A slight cloud darkened her face.
"No," she said. "Not this morning. I'd rather get out of the city."
"I thought you meant to be seen."
"Yes. Well, I don't want to meet anyone face to face."
She hurried him along unfamiliar streets toward the gates of the city. For a time, they walked in silence, and then Thassia spoke.
"It isn't really that I'm afraid to be seen," she said honestly. "I didn't want to wait for Jesus. I didn't want to see his face when he saw me like this."
Daniel was surprised. Then he remembered, dimly, the ancient law that forbade a man and woman to wear each other's garments.
"Are you worried about the law?" he asked.
"I don't think Jesus..."
"Oh, the law," she replied. "Yoel and I have broken so many laws lately that one more wouldn't matter." She paused, embarrassed, because he must know that any laws she and Yoel had broken had to do with their visits to Daniel's house. Then she hurried on.
"It's just that I don't want to face Jesus with a lie. I couldn't bear the way his eyes would look at me."
"If he understood the reason, he wouldn't blame you."
"Yes, I think he would," she said thoughtfully. "I think that for Jesus, a lie is impossible, no matter what the reason."
"In war, a lie is a weapon," said Daniel. "We have to use what weapons we have. Even Jesus must see that."
"I don't think he would see it at all," said Thassia.
She walked on a little way, then she spoke again.
"Daniel, what makes you and Yoel so sure that Jesus means to make war?"
"He says that the kingdom is at hand. What else can he mean?"
"Did you ever think he might mean that the kingdom will come some other way, without any fighting?"
"You mean just wait? Forever? Like your father says?"
Thassia's forehead wrinkled in an effort to put her thoughts into words.
"Not exactly. You see, Jesus has made me see that we don't need to wait for God to care for us. He does that now, every one of us. Jesus says that God sees into our hearts and loves us. If everyone understood that, every man and woman..."
"Would that rid us of the Romans?"
"Suppose the Romans too could understand."
He stopped in the road and stared at her.
"Romans? You think God loves the Romans?"
Thassia sighed.
"That's impossible, I suppose." "Then why does he say that we must love our enemies?"
"He is talking to men. A girl can't understand such things."
He said it rudely and too loudly, because Thassia's words had come close to his own secret doubts. So loudly that two passersby turned to stare at them, and Thassia lowered her head and hurried her steps. When she spoke again, she changed the subject.
"This thing that Yoel is doing, is it dangerous? I don't quite understand it. Why does Roche want those names?"
"I don't think it's dangerous," he told her, not quite truthfully. "Yoel thinks fast. Don't worry about him." The last part of her question he did not answer. He did not want to admit that he could not see why Roche wanted the names. Thassia was only too willing to accept his assurance, and at once she was confident again. They left the stone houses behind them, passed through the wall of Capernaum, taking special care to greet the sentries, and took the broad road that led north into the hills. All at once, Daniel's muscles tensed. He had seen, just ahead, two figures in the familiar metal helmets. Two soldiers rested beside the road, their heavy packs in the dust. One of them sat on the stone wall, his spear leaning beside him. The other was adjusting the strap of his sandal. But he glanced up now, and Daniel saw that it was too late even to consider turning back. "They're sure to speak to us," he cautioned Thassia under his breath.
"What if they do?" she asked. "That's what I came for, to be seen."
"All the same, you let me do the talking." The two soldiers watched their approach with interest.
"The gods have done us a favor after all," one of them said. "Didn't I predict it?"
"It's more than you deserve," said the other. "But who's to question the gods? Here, boy!"
With a snap of his finger, he indicated the two packs. A quick upward jerk of his elbow made his orders clear. Black anger rose in Daniel. He knew well enough the law that allowed a Roman to command that a Jew carry his burden for 1 mile. But the man didn't live who could make him shoulder a Roman pack. He looked squarely at the soldier. Then he spat, deliberately. The blow across his mouth came instantly and staggeringly, but he did not lower his head. The second soldier got to his feet, easily, carelessly, his eyes watchful. There was a stifled gasp. Then Thassia very quietly stepped forward and lifted one of the packs. It was heavier than she expected, and she paused a second, then made another try and hoisted it awkwardly to her shoulders. The soldiers waited. Daniel stood in helpless fury. Then, for the first time in his life, he bent his neck to the Roman yoke and picked up the second pack. He wanted to weep for shame. The blood pounded in his temples. He did not know which he hated more, the two soldiers or the girl who walked beside him, who had tricked him into this humiliation. He looked at her from the corner of his eye. She was walking at a fair pace, only a slight stagger betraying the effort. Let her stumble. Let her fall and see if he cared. In a moment, he looked sideways again. He saw the drops of moisture that clung to her forehead and trickled down her chin. Suddenly, shame for her flooded over his own. "Thassia!" "Put it down," he muttered, shifting closer to her. "I'll take mine on and come back for it."
"Nothing of the kind," she panted. "Keep quiet. Don't talk."
The two soldiers ambled behind them, chatting good-naturedly to each other, as though the two pack-bearers were mules. Finally, they reached the milestone. By rights, the soldiers could have made them go on, since they had taken the burdens well within the limits of the last stone. But Thassia's pace had become irksome, and it was obvious that though willing, she could do no better. So the owner of her pack shouldered it himself, and less willingly, the other let Daniel off also, with a parting blow on the ear for his sullenness. They strode ahead along the road, and Thassia sank down on the grass, rubbing her shoulder.
"Are you all right?"
Daniel asked finally, not looking at her.
"No thanks to you. What possessed you, Daniel?"
Daniel scowled down at the road. "The very sight of them makes me lose my head. Filthy foreigners. If you hadn't been with me, You'd have lost your silly head for good. How would that serve your country?
All right, he burst out. I made a fool of myself. Do you want to go back now?
Certainly not.
She sprang to her feet.
I want to see Leia.
They went on, Daniel keeping his eyes on the road ahead. But presently, stealing a furtive look at the girl beside him, Daniel discovered that she was looking directly at him.
I might as well be honest, Daniel, she said unexpectedly.
Back there?
I was proud of you. Scared to death, but proud too. If I were a boy, I hope I'd have the courage.
The frank words took Daniel by surprise. He could feel the pleasure of them spreading, warm as wine, along his veins. He had never had much praise in his life. He didn't know what to make of it. As they climbed the first rise from the plain, a breeze stirred their hot faces. On every side the land stretched, brown and parched under the summer sun. Here and there a solitary thresher still moved in a field, tossing the grain in great forkfuls into the air, letting the breeze catch the chaff while the heavy grain fell back to the ground. Presently, they reached the village. Outside his own door, Daniel knocked and called out, and presently, the bolt inside was quietly drawn back. As Daniel pushed open the door, Thassia stood back.
I have brought a friend of yours with me, Daniel announced.
Leia, from the corner where she had retreated at the first glimpse of an unfamiliar figure, stared out into the road. Then her face lighted.
Thassia,
she cried.
Why are you dressed in Yoel's clothes?
Thassia came into the room laughing and pushing back the hot turban with relief.
It's lucky everyone doesn't have your sharp eyes, she said. You won't give me away, will you? It's a sort of game we're playing.
Leia came forward slowly.
Daniel never plays games, she said soberly.
What a pity, said Thassia lightly.
Yoel and I pretend all sorts of things. But I'll tell you a secret. Your brother does know how to smile. Quite nicely, actually. He doesn't always hide behind that fearful scowl.
Unexpectedly, Leia giggled, and then both girls were laughing. Scowling more fiercely than ever, Daniel stamped into his shop, but he left the door open behind him. In Thassia's lighthearted presence, Leia was a different girl altogether. As he worked, Daniel caught, between the hissing of the forge and the blows of his hammer, the sound of their voices, and over again, Leia's soft laughter. When he crossed the room for a tool, he could see them, the two heads, dark and fair, bent over a bit of sewing. He found a good many excuses for walking across the shop that morning. At noon, they ate their meal together. Leia spread out with pride the hard bread and the olives and the inferior dates, not knowing how meager the fare really was. With every bite, Daniel remembered the fine white cloth, the damask couches, the wine in alabaster cups. But Thassia seemed to have forgotten. What was there about her? He wondered. A sort of naturalness that made her seem without the slightest effort to belong, no matter where she happened to be. On the mountain? In the luxury of her own home? Among the fishing boats? Her gaiety touched with a special grace everything around her. Leia had begun to clear the dishes when some sound distracted her. Daniel, leaning back on his elbows, only half awake in the heavy heat, caught first the look on his sister's face. She was staring through the open door of the shop, and a deep flush was rising slowly from her throat to her pale temples. Daniel sat up. Then he caught the flash of sunlight on a helmet. The pleasure of the moment exploded like a bubble. In an instant, he was on his feet, had flung himself into the shop, and slammed the door shut behind him. He had thought he had seen the last of the blonde Roman. What had brought the man back? Curse him, too, for choosing to bring his work in the heat of the day. In a black humor, he blew up the fire. When the shadows began to lengthen in the little room, they all knew with regret that the visit must end. Before they set out for the city,
Daniel took Thassia into his shop. "You have brought so many gifts to Leia," he said, trying to choose his words carefully. "Would you let me give one to you?" He reached into a deep niche in the wall and drew out a small object wrapped in a fragment of Leia's blue cloth. Awkwardly, he laid in Thassia's hand the little brooch. "I made it with a bit of scrap," he said. Thassia stood looking down at it.
"A bronze bow," she whispered.
"Do you remember? It was you who thought of it that night. That the bronze bow might mean some impossible thing. The thing we could not do alone? I never forgot it. I don't know how to say it, but it came to stand for everything we are working for our oath, for the kingdom." He had never seen Thassia before when she could not speak. He would remember as long as he lived the look that sprang into her eyes and was quickly hidden as she bent her head. Then her words came hurrying out.
"To think that you made it," she exclaimed, her voice shaky. "Why, you ought to be a silversmith, Daniel. You shouldn't be working with these great chunks of iron."
"I'd like to try," he confessed. "Perhaps someday, when we are at peace." It was the first time he had ever voiced his ambition, even to himself. They set out together along the road, Thassia with the turban snugly about her head once more.
"Every time I come, Leia has changed," she told him. "It's like watching a flower opening very slowly. From week to week, I can hardly wait to see how it has opened since I saw her last."
"It is due to you," Daniel told her humbly. "She has never had a friend before. After you leave, I see her trying to do things the way you do them."
Thassia smiled at him.
"Little things," she said. "Her hair and the way she folds her veil. That's not what I mean."
"She does almost all the work in the house now," he went on.
"But there are days when she goes back." He was grateful for a chance to speak of this to someone.
"Days when she doesn't pay any attention. It's hard for me to have patience enough."
Thassia smiled again.
"No, no one would ever take you for an impatient man," she said. "But do you think Yoel and I do not know what you have done for Leia?"
Daniel's gratitude went out to her. He would like to think he had done something to make up for those years.
"She is so lovely," Thassia went on thoughtfully. "I can't believe there are really any demons in her. Have you ever asked a physician?"
"The one in the village said there was no cure for her. Once there was a man traveling through the country who had magic power to heal, and my grandmother paid him to look at Leia. He could not do anything either. He said that the demons that make a person afraid are the hardest to cast out. He said something queer. Leia was only a child, but he said that she did not want to be made well."
Thassia was silent for a moment. "I have heard Jesus say something like that when people ask him to cure them. Once there was a lame man on a litter. Jesus bent over him and looked right into his face and asked him, 'Do you want to be whole?' It seemed such a queer question. Why would anyone want to stay crippled?"
Daniel hesitated. This was something he had thought about, walking alone on the dark, silent road from Bethsaida. He was not sure of his own thoughts.
"Haven't you ever wondered," he attempted, "what good it is for them to be healed, those people that Jesus cures? They're happy at first, but what happens to them after that? What does a blind man think when he has wanted for years to see and then looks at his wife in rags and his children covered with sores? That lame man you saw, is he grateful now? Is it worth it to get on his feet and spend the rest of his life dragging burdens like a mule?"
"I never thought of it that way," said Thassia, her eyes clouding.
"Is that why, do you think, that so many of them aren't cured?"
The thought was troubling to them both. They walked on in uncertain silence. Then Thassia's naturally happy spirits reasserted themselves.
"Have you thought, Daniel, of taking Leia to Jesus?"
"Yes, I've thought of it," but I don't see how I could get her to Capernaum without frightening her to death. She asked once if Jesus would ever come to our village, but I don't suppose she would really have the courage. When he comes, if she will not go to him, then you must ask him to come to your house with you. He often goes with people, you know.
To the centurion's house, or to some rich man's.
Do you really think that would make the slightest difference to Jesus?
No. No, I guess it wouldn't. But somehow I wonder. It's the same as the lame man. It's not much of a world, is it? Is it worth trying to bring Leah back into it? Thasia stood still in the road.
Yes,
she cried, and Daniel was astounded to see that tears had sprung into her eyes.
Oh, Daniel, yes. If only I could make you see, somehow, that it is. All this,
she exclaimed, the sweep of her arm including the deepening blue of the sky, the shining lake in the distance, the snow-covered mountain far to the north.
So much. You must look at it all, Daniel, not just at the unhappy things.
Suddenly she reached out and touched his hand.
Look,
she whispered. He lifted his head and followed her gaze. Overhead, barely discernible against the blue of the sky, a long gray shadow hung suspended. Cranes, hundreds of them, were passing in a great phalanx. They wheeled and caught the sun, flashing light from banks of white feathers, with a shimmering like the snow on the mountain. Motionless, the two watched till the line slowly melted into the distant air. Thasia let out her breath.
How beautiful,
she sighed.
It is beautiful just to be alive in Galilee.
Daniel looked down at her. Her head was still thrown back, her lips parted. He could see the pulse beating under the smooth ivory skin. And somehow, the line of her throat was one with the long, slow arc of the birds in flight. She was aware all at once of his look, and then that their hands were joined. Red surged up into the smooth cheeks, and she drew her hand away. For a moment, neither of them moved, and then they both began to hurry, almost to run. At the junction of the road, they passed two more Roman sentries, but this time the men did not speak or even take notice of two dusty boys. For once, Daniel felt almost grateful to a Roman. Tonight, he could not have borne to watch Thasia shoulder a pack. 17. The Bronze Bow.
This time,
the villagers said, as Daniel halted the blows of his hammer,
Roche has gone too far.
How do you know it was Roche?
Daniel inquired, keeping his eyes on the axe he was mending.
Is there any other man in Galilee who would dare such a thing? Five of the wealthiest houses in the city robbed last night. But how would he find out? That's what I can't see. How would he know, off there on the mountain, that Mattathias was giving a banquet? Or which men would have taken half their slaves to make a showing? None of the rest of us even knew the Tetrarch was coming.
Then how can you think it was Roche?
I don't have to think. The legionaries found out. Roche might have got away with it if he'd been satisfied with the loot from the houses, but no, he had to make a night of it.
Daniel started. Was there more to the story that had not yet reached him? Hand on the bellows, he waited.
They tried the house of the centurion himself. He might have known the centurion wouldn't leave his house unguarded. Most likely the cutthroats got careless when they found the other houses such easy picking. Two of them were captured. Both escaped convicts anyway, they say. One died as soon as they started to question him, but the other told before they finally made an end of him.
Which?
Daniel wondered sickly. Which of the men he had lived with side by side in the cave?
I say they deserved what they got. Nothing but a pack of thieves up there, for all the fine talk we used to hear.
Not for a moment could Daniel let such a statement pass in his shop. Roche is no bandit.
he said. When he robs, it is for a good purpose.
So I've heard. Rob the rich to feed the poor. I'll be glad to see the poor that gets one penny of what he took last night.
There may be more important needs, said Daniel.
Like filling his own stomach? We'll see if he's satisfied now. We'll see if he lets our crops alone. I'll believe you when we can trust our sheep on the mountain.
Daniel started up the bellows and cut off the rest of the man's complaint. This was the third man since morning who had brought the news that had slithered out from the city, like a swarm of snakes to every village round about. Some men praised Roche's daring, elated to see the rich men defrauded, but more, like this man, were indignant. At the first news, Daniel's spirits had soared. Then, on the heels of rejoicing, had come doubt. Now, at the end of the day, he felt dull and let down. This, then, had been the reason for Yoel's enterprise? A wholesale looting of rich men's houses. Somehow both boys had expected something more noble, more worthy of the cause. What did Yoel think of it? Was it worth the hours lost from his study, the danger? No question what Yoel thought. That night, the meeting in the watchtower was jubilant. Bit by bit, the boys from the city had garnered every crumb of news to relate to the village boys. Yoel was a hero twice over. Not only had he furnished all the information that had made the raid possible, he had even returned this morning to the very doors of the robbed houses to listen to the full story from the unsuspecting kitchen slaves.
"I'm going to keep at it," he boasted. "It would be a shame to give up such an opening. I've got a special order from the centurion's head steward. 2 dozen fish every second and fourth day of the week. There's no telling what I may chance on."
He was far too elated to notice Daniel's silence.
"Is Roche in danger?" one of the boys asked. "The yellow rat who was caught."
"Yellow?" another boy objected. "Do you know what the Romans do to a man? How long do you think you could keep quiet?"
There was an uncomfortable pause. This was a doubt they all faced in the night, in their own secret thoughts. They did not often speak of it. "Don't worry about Roche," Daniel assured them. "The Romans have had a price on Roche's head for years. It's another matter to lay a finger on him." Questions broke out again. What would Roche do with the money? Would he buy arms with it? Would he divide it among the farms? Maybe pay back for some of the sheep he had killed?